Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Unstoppable Mindset, where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Today, we get to deal with probably a little bit of all. Our guest is Dr. Gabe Roberts, who specializes in psychosomatic illness, and I'm not going to try to give a long explanation of that because I think that's something that he can do a whole lot better than I, but Gabe, if I can call you Gabe, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thank you, Michael, for having me today.
We're glad you're here. So I'd like to start by not dealing directly with psychosomatic illnesses, but rather, how did you get started in all this? Tell us a little bit about you.
Okay. So for the last decade, my wife and I have ran a functional medicine clinic in Kansas City, where we worked with a number of chronically ill people, including, you know, Lyme disease and mystery illnesses, everything from chronic pain, depression, and most often these people have exhausted conventional resources. Basically, they were looking for deeper answers. So they would come to us and we would run more sophisticated lab tests than what they were used to seeing. And we would use advanced nutritional protocols and herbal medicine and energy medicine, including acupuncture. I was a best practitioner, which means bioenergetic synchronization technique. So just a variety of energy medicines and nutritional support to try to stimulate healing. And what we noticed over this 10-year period and with nearly 2,000 patients from all over the world, that many of the times within a year and a half of doing our care, 6 months to a year and a half, they would be ill again. They would have some kind of ailment that came back. And so this kind of troubled us. And what it did was it made me dig deeper into figuring out what it is that really is the root cause of why people get ill. And what we found was it has to do with a significant amount of turmoil, traumas, things like that in the ages of 0 to 6 years old. It always goes back to something that occurred to them. And this might be foreign to some people, but what we want to understand is at that age, our brain is growing so fast, a million connections per second, that by the time a child reaches the age of 7, they've already learned half of what they'll know the rest of their life, including their beliefs, including how they feel about themselves, including how they feel about life itself, if it's threatening or if it's welcoming. Many things like that. So today what we do is we don't use nutrition and we don't use all these fancy lab tests. I mean, we do encourage people to eat good and drink good water, but what we do is we go back in their timeline using advanced holographic manipulation therapy work to go back and find the memory that has to do the exact millisecond that has to do with why their body's not healing correctly. We resolve that, and their neurology, their nervous system has no choice but to follow the deepest orders of the unconscious mind and their issues begin to resolve, whether it's autoimmune or chronic pain or digestive disturbances and so forth.
When you say holographic memory, what do you mean by that?
So each memory we have, all our thoughts, all our memories, all of our five senses work through a holographic image inside of our neurology. And what a hologram is a three-dimensional image. It's basically a sealed, encapsulated ball of light. So anytime we have an experience, for instance, let's say we have a traumatic experience. And what I mean by trauma is just any time that the nervous system is overwhelmed. It doesn't have to be a battlefield. It could be a playground incident. And what happens is our conscious mind splits. It splits in two. Part of that split continues to go on with our day-to-day life. The other part of that actually gets walled off and contained in a holographic container. So it's basically a three-dimensional image where everything in that memory is running on an endless loop. Right. So the energy, the mood, the frequencies, if it was painful, all the pain, everything is stored in that basically an envelope, and it's running all the time. And the part of the neurology that understands and interprets this has the impression that it's still continuing, it's still going on. And this is basically the mechanism for things like post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. That's why they say that the soldier can leave the battlefield, but the battlefield doesn't necessarily leave the soldier. And I know this too well because I was a Marine for 8 years as well. So mechanisms of this are very familiar with me.
And so what you do is essentially, if I'm reading it right, go in and try to penetrate the hologram or break the hologram and change the interpretation of what's there or update it?
That's correct. And what we do is we use a specific technique to exactly find that millisecond of overwhelm. And once we locate that hologram, that traumatic memory, we can insert the missing frequencies. We can actually, if there's any kind of safety lessons that the unconscious mind has linked in and encoded in part of that, we can address those, as well as reframe it in a way to where now it's a situation where the person survived and did fine. It's not the situation where the person is still in a threatening circumstance. So you are correct. We actually find that, reframe it, address all the fragments of the hologram, and use a few specific mechanisms to allow the nervous system to latch onto that.
I can relate. For me, 20 years ago, I worked on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center and was there on September 11th with a guide dog, Roselle. And of course, everything happened that happened. But I had done a great deal of work ahead of time learning how to, if you will, live, survive, and function in the World Trade Center. As a blind person, I chose not to rely on depending on other people to get me out, but rather I learned what to do in the case of an emergency. I learned the whole complex and so on. And what I realized significantly later, and especially over the last 2 years in thinking about it, took a long time to think about it, was that in reality, I had learned to control what could have been my fears, and that with things like the pandemic, we see so many people today afraid of so many things. And it's not just the pandemic. It's been there all along. I've met any number of people who still can't really move forward from September 11th. And what I realized is that I had changed or adopted a mindset. And so when things happened on September 11th, the mindset kicked in. And the mindset basically said, you know what to do. You don't need to run in panic and be, as I describe it, blinded by fear. And it seems to me that we live in a world today where so many people in so many ways are just encouraged to live in fear, and if you will, have all these little holograms inside of them that are sending these horrible messages that they never learn to address.
Correct. And that's correct. And literally, these holograms come to the surface to our conscious awareness. It's important to understand that our unconscious mind is literally mathematically 99.994%. So what we are aware of is less than a thousandth of a percentage of our mind. And these holographic memories come to the surface of our conscious awareness anywhere from 15 to 50 times an hour. We constantly leave the present moment, and we revisit the past over and over and over. And whatever's in that hologram actually gets interpreted to the nervous system. And we know this for sure. We don't know the difference between the event or actually the memory of the event. And what you're describing is basically strengthening a part of your consciousness to where you can maintain that control. Most people don't. And what I mean by that is when something hits, when an emotional disturbance hits or a huge event happens, a tragedy, perhaps like September 11th, you had a mindset to where you could keep your conscious part in control. Because typically what happens is that conscious mind of us that we are aware of, we listen to the voice in our head, and we're, you know, aware of our names and some basic things like this, like we're sitting in a room right now and it's, you know, the 18th of December. We're all aware of those things. But that part of us also immediately clocks out the minute something, a huge emotional shift happens. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, we go to the autopilot, which is where these holographic memories are stored. And we kind of start going off of primal responses rather than being in control of the situation. And that's what I would say you learn to do. And this can happen with people that are trained in military situations, also have this this same ability to basically keep a cool head when things go south.
It doesn't mean that they're not aware or don't have fear or that things are occurring that go in and create those holograms that may be negative, but they have learned to overcome that and essentially change the vertices, if you will, and make the experience one that doesn't have to be so negative, as I gather it.
Right, right.
And you know, so is it appropriate to say what you do in part is to try to help people kind of couple their conscious and unconscious minds together more so that they become more aware of what's in their unconscious mind and try to also use the positive parts of that and deal with the negative parts and be able to maintain control?
Not so much help them be in control. What we do with holographic manipulation therapy is we go to the very, very first source of that challenge. So let's say a person comes to me and they have severe digestive disturbances. And actually, this just happened last week. I had a woman in Canada seek me out. Severe digestive disturbances for years. I'm like 20 years and has tried everything, every kind of lab test and every kind of nutritional supplement. And she comes to me. I work 100% through Zoom. And so I told her that this has a specific spot, this feeling, because everything in our bodies is governed by feelings. Everything about human nature has to do with a feeling we want more of or a feeling we want less of. And feelings give us an access route to those holographic stored memories. So using a specific set of questions, we went right to the center of that stored hologram that's responsible for why her digestive system is not functioning properly. And next thing you know, she's 6 years old getting spanked. And so what we did, so instead of trying to teach her how to control her mind a little better, we went to the very, very primary when this first occurred, when her nervous system first recorded this incident, and reframe that to where her dad was welcoming, to where the energy was completely different in that room. We supplied the missing frequencies. So that entire three-dimensional hologram was completely different. It was a completely different structure. And in just doing that one time, she went from having, I think it was 15 bowel movements a day to having one, just that one changing that hologram in the neurology absolutely changed her physiological health. Because again, we don't know that that's over. And why do we have to go all the way back? Because those are the very, very most important memories a person has. The very first time something like that occurs, it becomes the standard by which everything else is measured by. Whenever we see people living in fear today about the pandemic or about September 11th or about anything else you care to name off, I mean, it could be global warming. I mean, it could be just anything you could care to name off. That fear is not from these current circumstances. Mm-hmm. They aren't thinking. They're remembering unconsciously. They're remembering some kind of incident that occurred long ago that is being re-triggered by events. The same with a person that has road rage, a person that has anger or rage. They're never upset that somebody cut them off. It appears that way. And they could even tell you, this guy really upset me because he cut me off. It's not that. It's all the previous occurrences of anger that have ever been stored in his body through holograms, starting with the very, very initial one as a child, that are all getting re-stimulated, replayed over and over again. And the momentum from those makes it to where he has this burst of outrage when someone cuts him off.
I guess what I was meaning by control was not so much controlling the whatever it is, but rather controlling, or maybe it's better to just say that people connect conscious and unconscious to be able to reframe, or even in current events, properly frame how they remember and how they record it.
Right. Because that does change a significant amount of how they operate, how their body functions, how their entire endocrine system begins to function, their fight or flight mechanisms, everything, by remembering something different. Because memories are pliable. Memories are just like recordings.
Right. And I think that the whole issue with fear, and I use the words controlling fear, and maybe there are better ways to phrase it. And we're beginning to write a new book about fear and controlling, or helping people move on from being afraid. The premise is that we mostly all face unexpected life events and life changes, and we don't know how to deal with those life changes. We just become, as I describe it, blinded by fear. And the reality is that it probably isn't so much that we don't know what to do, but we haven't learned to reframe our experiences in a way that enhances our ability to truly interpret it, or maybe better to say, strengthens our ability to handle it in the right way.
Right. And to know, you know, in those kind of circumstances, to know that if we trust our gut instincts, if we learn how to trust our intuition, go with our gut feelings, those ways will be shown to us. Yeah. But oftentimes, whenever we have suffered trauma, especially as a child, and it could be, again, mechanisms that are not so drastic that has to do with violence and all these other things, but yeah, just maybe not being held enough, or maybe even, I mean, I've regressed people back and they were waking up in their bedroom at night alone, and there was a bad thunderstorm and they were scared. And, you know, that's nothing the parents did wrong. It's just an incident where a child felt frightened, and it has to his nervous system. It's all data. It's all the same. It's all the same thing. Whenever this occurs to us, oftentimes we kind of let that intuition go. We start to trust our conscious mind to navigate us instead of our unconscious mind. And we listen to the voice in our head that tells us things. And that conscious part of us that generates the voice is the least informed and the last to know anything. If we listen to that, it's usually the one that justifies and rationalizes and tells us in our head, everything's fine. You got this under control. Meanwhile, the vehicle's going off the road. So it's our gut feelings that we need to learn to listen to. And they're the silent ones. They're the ones that if you've ever been in a circumstance, perhaps driving a car or something, and you get this urge, take this exit instead. And another part of you says, no, I'm tired. I just want to get home and relax. And you go around the curve and suddenly traffic is backed up. We talked ourselves out of listening to that intuition, where the intuition is there to kind of guide us and give us these assistance, you know, through life to where we can, you know, navigate it much, much easier. It's like a built-in GPS.
My favorite example, and I used it a number of times, of dealing with instinct and talking about the thing that you mentioned exactly, is Trivial Pursuit. I like to play Trivial Pursuit, and I can't count the number of times that a question has come up that I didn't know the answer to, or in talking to other people that they didn't know the answer to, but something said to me, this is the answer. And every time I've listened, I mean, every single time I've listened to that inner voice, that intuition, it was the right answer. And every time I haven't listened, it was the wrong answer. And it's so I absolutely believe in what you're talking about. And as you said, dealing with traffic and so on, and what I've learned to do, and it takes work because of what we're taught in our conscious world, is to really listen to that intuition, listen to that inner voice, because it is so often right that we're missing a lot by not paying attention.
Right. That's correct. One of the ways I helped us with patients to help them trust that intuition, because that's what's going to guide us. That's where we find the holograms. That's where we find the real answers, not the answers that the conscious mind generates, but the answers that the unconscious has stored and generates. As well as the therapist I teach, I have a school now where I teach this to doctors and therapists, how to effectively clear trauma in patients. And one of the things I teach them is the unconscious mind always answers first. Within 3 seconds, when you ask a question, such as a Trivial Pursuit answer, within 3 seconds, your entire gut, which is a major sensory organ, scans the entire environment. You have 13 trillion neurological cells in your body instantly scanned, and it gives you an answer within 3 seconds. Oftentimes that answer is so faint, we think we're making it up. We have an insane urge to want to edit it. And because it's not loud, it's a faint little feeling, we oftentimes talk ourselves out of it.
How do we teach more people to pay attention to their intuition, their inner mind, their unconscious mind talking with them? I mean, you deal with patients and so on, but how do we get people to move beyond what we have been unfortunately trained to do, to get to, excuse me, a point where we start to listen to that more?
Well, I think, and that's a great question. I think a big part of it is to realize that, you know, first off, what you call was a conscious culture, basically. Okay. I'm a doctor of chiropractic, and they never really trained us on any kind of intuition during my whole 4 years there, 8 years of school. So it's not in academia. It's not taught in our educational system. It's the dominant thought in all our healthcare today about this subconscious, this, you know, inner mind is almost looked at like taboo.
Yeah.
So a big part of my work has been learning how to address this. So the big part that I think is to have people understand that there is plenty of science there's more than enough science showing that we are far more than we perceive to be. A man named Masaru Emoto in Japan actually demonstrated this on water. Basically, he had a group of students put an intention towards water. They froze the water, and then they looked at it under a microscope, and you can see different types of intentional thoughts put in water reveal itself as these beautiful patterns through looking at our microscope, like joy and love and bliss were just beautiful symmetrical patterns under a microscope. And contrast that when they wrote the word hate or disgust and they froze that and looked, it looked like an oil spill or a broken glass. Now that might sound like one isolated event, but Cleve Baxter in the 1960s is another, he's FBI's most trusted polygraph analyst in the United States at the time. He basically taught people around the world how to pass lie detectors and how to do polygraph tests on criminals and things like that. And basically he put a lie detector test on a plant and decided that he was going to see if it would stimulate his machine. And he thought, well, he first dunked the leaves in hot coffee and nothing happened. Then he thought, well, I'm going to up it a bit. I'm going to up the threat mode of this plant. And he goes, I'll burn a leaf. The minute he reached for a match, the plant jumped up on his machine. So the plant read his thoughts. And now this might sound kind of out there, but Mythbusters, the popular scientific group on Discovery Channel, heard about this and they successfully reproduced it. And this is all, you can find it on YouTube. You can find where these guys look at a plant and they threaten to burn it with nothing more than thinking, and the plant registers. So this goes to show that our mind is far more than just some electrical activity inside of our brain. And what happens with our thoughts, especially our dominant thoughts, which are the ones that run below the surface of awareness, when we start to get those harmonized in a way that works for us, you know, the way where we start to feel empowered, where we start to feel like we're a lovable person, where we feel important, where we feel that we are enough and we can do the things we want to do without the, you know, if we have a dream or a desire we want to do, or if we have a condition we want to heal from. All that is purely possible, but it's just a matter of understanding that there's something you, somewhere along the line, you learned that you can't do it. And your mind is extremely powerful. And if you can start to understand that the memories you have are not you, they're simply recordings. And, you know, you start to envision and you start to put a lot of emotion towards what you want, and start to isolate the things that say you can't and look at those and understand that they're not really you. They're just simply recordings that you heard as a young kid. You can be right on the path of absolutely changing your life. And I've read dozens, hundreds of archives of people that have had miraculous healings from anything from being paralyzed to people that were paralyzed in a hospital in India, and a cobra came in the room, and within 30 seconds, a cobra came through the window. Within 30 seconds, everyone ran out of that ward, and some of them had been paralyzed for, you know, 12 years. And this is no different than we see in clinical trials involving placebos. What happens when a person has diabetes and they are under the belief they're under the impression this medication is going to help them out. They take it and all of a sudden their blood sugar stabilizes and it turned out to be just a sugar pill. What happened? That person instantly changed their identity, and that basically opened up a new cosmetic, or I would say cosmic internet of possibilities and probabilities, including healing.
We'll go back to the cobra a second. The other side of that is, how would the cobras react if we reacted mentally to them differently, if we didn't just exude fear or terror, but rather put forth conscious efforts of love and so on. And I think that there have been so many examples of how animals have reacted positively to that.
You're exactly right. So it's not just water and it's not just plants, but it's actually animals. And we can see that because there's people that can actually get close and touch these, you know, these yeah. things that would generate fear in most people, cobras. And even talking about someone like the crocodile hunter, Steve Irwin, mm-hmm. you know, whenever he would get down close to one of these cobras, you know, deep down his intuition was nothing but an admiration for this creature. And it sensed that versus someone else that would have a complete fear or even try to, you know, run from it or even try to hurt it. Down in his intuition, he never had that. And so the cobra sensed that he was okay. And even though I get annoyed with him, but it wouldn't ever go into a full threat response. Right.
Right.
So a man named Rupert Sheldrick actually has demonstrated some of what you're talking about in our ability to influence animals, in particular cats. There's an interesting correlation with this in the UK. I think it's London. There's 58 out of the 60 major veterinarian clinics. If you contacted them and said, I'd like to bring my cat in on this Wednesday to have this kind of procedure or this appointment done, they'll actually say, we don't schedule ahead for cats. Just bring your cat in whenever you get the chance and we'll see them then. And why would they do that? Because most cat owners had to reschedule throughout, you know, they've had a history yeah. of, because the cat picks up on the intuition to go to the vet that day and actually disappears or runs and hides somewhere. So what you're talking about, us being able to communicate in a way with animals based on our intuition is actually reproducible, scientifically validated. And it's very interesting. It just goes to show that we're connected in many ways that that go beyond what we hear about, what our educational system discusses and what our healthcare system acknowledges.
We have a cat who I'm getting to the point where I think it's a game, but she absolutely hates to go to the vet. That is to say, if we give her any advance warning, she will hide. If we don't say anything and try to keep that out of our mind, we can get her, put her in her crate, put her in the car and go to the vet. She'll yell all the way there. But when we get there, every single time, she's as happy as a clam at high tide, loves to be there, goes in. They never have a problem with her. And we've had other vets who have just said to us, well, we don't do cats for like trimming nails and so on. We just don't because they're too much of a problem. But this cat loves it once she's there. So I'm almost getting to the point where I think it's just part of the game because she really, and then coming home, she is just as sedate as could be and never acts traumatized at all. So, you know, they do play games too.
Right. And you notice how, and see, cats are a little more sensitive than, yeah. than other animals. But you notice when you said we keep it out of our mind.
And yes.
We can get her. I would say that if you even had the intention, if you were thinking about it and you're like, okay, today's the day, we're taking her to the vet. Hope everything goes well. Hope she's not, you know, creating mm-hmm. ruckus and all this. And you give no outside influences.
Yep.
No cage sitting out, nothing like that for the cat to know. The cat will still pick up on your intuition and yeah. and run and hide.
Well, again, it's interesting. It's pretty clear she's not really afraid when she goes and hide. And that's why I think it's more of a game. She likes to play games with us anyway. She never acts fearful. And like with people, if somebody comes into the house, she generally will stay away. But if we pick her up and take her out and introduce her, you can't get rid of her. So I think she's a very interesting cat. She's the most vocal cat and the most articulate cat that we have ever had. I've heard instances of people who are blind using guide dogs. I know of one person who went to a guide dog school to get trained with a dog. It wasn't his first dog. But he started saying to the trainers, we're not hitting it off at all. And the trainer said, but you guys are working so well together. And this person, I don't even remember now who it was, but he said, I can't describe it, but we're just not hitting it off. There's something in the psyche that's just not working between us. And they eventually respected that and gave him a different dog. But again, I think it's something in the intuition or in the relationship between the two creatures wasn't melding very well. And again, that's part of the overall issue. When I go to get a new guide dog, and I'm on number 8 since 1964, I tell everyone, and I've been able to establish a relationship with everyone, but I tell everyone it takes a year to truly develop the relationship that we want to have, because although a dog may indeed truly unconditionally love, what they do not do is unconditionally trust. And trust has to be earned, and that bond has to be created all the way around.
Right. Absolutely.
And it's fascinating to see that relationship grow, and I'm very aware of it. And so I love to develop those relationships. And I think that so often, once again, we just tend to be afraid of so many things that we teach fear, like with dealing with disabilities. One of the things I talk a lot about on Unstoppable Mindset is disabilities, and especially blindness. For years, one of the top 5 fears in this country, according to the Gallup Polling Organization, was going blind, not even becoming disabled, because we teach everyone that eyesight's the only game in town. When in reality, all of you sighted people only get to do things at night because Thomas Edison and others invented the electric light bulb for light dependent people, right? And you don't get along very well without light. But the reality is we learn to fear something that is so different than what we're used to. And we never go back and think more about the fact that, well, why is it such a bad thing to be blind? We live in such a technological world today that means that so many things can be made available. And ironically, because we live in a technological world where it's possible to make everything accessible, we're also seeing much more graphics and things are becoming more inaccessible, which is very frustrating.
Right.
You know, and how do you deal with that? And so it still gets back to how do we deal with breaking some of the cycles? And it is all about education, of course, isn't it?
It is in a sense for the people that are definitely wanting more. The people that are definitely wanting to know more. I've studied the mind in depth, and one thing I do know is people will unconsciously reject anything that doesn't match their own identity. They just unconsciously, intentionally, sometimes unwillingly, they just reject it, and they'll also reject something that doesn't match with what they believe to be true. And so the people that have flexible truths that allow new information in as it's available, and perhaps even more beneficial information, those are the ones that will absolutely thrive. And those are the ones that will be able to produce changes in the lives they want. Where sometimes if a person is not willing to change, there's no amount of education will actually work for them.
We're seeing a lot of that today, aren't we, with the pandemic and just the whole fractured political environment. There's so many people who just don't trust and aren't willing to look at alternatives for what they believe. And it's hard to figure out how to deal with that.
Right. I would say that's absolutely true. And it goes down to, you know, one of the things that I think is responsible for that is the fact that we lost connection on purpose. And we found that connection through like the television. Yeah. And when we're hooked to something like that, it becomes almost a substitute for that connection. And now as as harmful as it might be, we are, you know, in a time now where we are fearful. We're using our own, I'd say the powers to be are using our own neurology against us. Mm-hmm. People that have families are conflicted. There's a great amount of fear, and you know, it's just a very odd time.
It is. And we never step back and look at what we do, or we very seldom ever step back and look at what we do. One of the things I like to do, especially when I speak, and I do a fair amount of speaking to the public, is I record them and listen to them, more like doing podcasts. I like to go back and listen because I want to hear what I did. I am a firm believer in I'm my own worst critic. And that's a good thing, because I will learn from what I do. And I think it's important that we all should do that. We shouldn't just go through the day doing what we do. At some point, we should step back a little bit and think about what happened, and was this the right choice, or what could I have done better, and look to that inner part of us to help create change. And you're right. People often just don't want to change at all.
Right. It's just the way we're wired.
Yeah.
And if you become aware of that, it's something you can easily overcome. It's something you can easily overcome, just to be aware of how your system works. And it's natural to reject those things, but you often want to ask, well, what's this new information? What if it benefits me? It might even be uncomfortable to step into this, you know, this new unfamiliar territory. But that's where positive change comes. Otherwise, we tend to just keep doing the same things, and we keep doing the same things, we get the same results.
Well, you just said, we're wired, and we're wired the way we're wired. The question ultimately is, can we change the way we're wired? And I'm kind of hearing you say we can, and there's a way to do that.
Right. And that's becoming aware of the resistance, the way our body naturally resists things. We resist anything that doesn't match with how we see ourselves. That's why oftentimes, whenever I talk with people, I'll even talk with women, and I'll say, can you take a compliment? If your spouse gave you a compliment, or a partner, or if you were single and you were dating again and you met a guy and he gave you a compliment, would you be able to take it? And in most of the cases, it might be flattering to them, but they really can't accept it. Even if mm-hmm. these women put a lot of work into making themselves groomed and looking good, they still have trouble accepting that compliment. That's just one example of how they reject something that doesn't match what was there first. Maybe they weren't told as a young child that they are a beautiful, you know, a beautiful young girl or something. So that we also resist anything that conflicts with how others will see us. So we always try to put on a show. We create stories. We do things to make sure we always look the best for people. And we also want to do what the consensus is. We don't want to. And again, this is just, it doesn't mean it's right. It just means it's naturally how we're wired. They've done a lot of social experience where people they'll do what the consensus is, even if they know it's wrong.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
And then we reject anything that, that conflicts with what we believe to be true. I believe if we understand those, that starts us the path of that starts us on the path of going beyond that and working against how we're wired to do. And that's where fantastic changes as in through history, there's been a number of people that have understood this. They've stood out. Buckminster Fuller, Edison with the mm-hmm. light bulb you mentioned, even today, Elon Musk, you know, so these are people that fully accepted information. They didn't care what others thought, and they did what really made them feel good.
Well, I go back to dogs again. You know, I'm talking about dogs don't necessarily unconditionally trust, but the difference between dogs and people is that dogs, unless something incredibly wretched happened to them, are more open to trust. So you talked about the women accepting a compliment, you know, they're also probably unconsciously, if nothing else, wondering and consciously wondering, well, what's their real reason for saying that? And we live in that kind of a world that trust is so under attack.
It is. It is. I mean, we trust and connection. You know, we have a tremendous amount of divorce rates in the United States, but we're also in a society to where if you go to the supermarket and you're getting groceries and you accidentally brush hands with a stranger, it's almost awkward.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're not taught in this culture, and it's not anyone's fault. It's just something we've lost. It's something we've lost as a human species. And that's where a lot of my work comes into play, dealing with trauma is, you know, you rewind the clock back several thousand years ago to where we as humans were much more mobile, and we were in big groups where the men hunted. The child was held for the first 3 years of life, held by the mom, the dad, the grandma, the grandpa, the aunt, the uncle. Everyone in this tribe was willing to hold the child for the first 3 years, and that had a huge impact on their brain development because of the intuition of, you know, connection. The child needs connection. And even if a parent, let's say in that situation, a dad went out for a hunt and actually was killed in an accident, the child wouldn't be as traumatized because someone would step up and there'd be that connection. That connection would be fulfilled. So the child would still growing up whole with the biological need met. Now today, it always goes back to that. That's where most trauma is. Today, whenever I regress people back to that first circumstance, it always goes to an emotional need not met. And it's not because the parent was bad. It's because we've lost that as a society. And chances are that parent didn't get that emotional need met either, and so on and so forth. It's not genetic, it's behavioral that gets passed down. Mm-hmm. And I would say with your instance about dogs and having that year to fully bond where you really trust each other and the dog trusts you, I would say if you had the intention of this dog, if you really just focused your inner thoughts on this dog of welcoming it in your presence, and you just
right.
Day one, when you got that dog home, if you literally thought, I welcome you in my presence and I'm full of joy to have you in my presence, I would guess that trust the dog begins to build with you.
Yes.
Would happen much, much, much sooner within probably days to weeks versus a full year.
I think the trust develops very quickly, but I think what takes a while is just really learning how to interpret each other from a physical and practical standpoint. It's just a process of really getting to know each other. But I agree with exactly what you're saying. You know, if you're open to trust and you convey that, the trust itself happens very quickly. It's just the whole process can take a while to learn the logistics.
Right.
Well, we're going to have to stop, unfortunately, but would you be willing to do more of this and do it again?
Absolutely, Michael.
Perfect.
I appreciate you calling me in. This was great.
How do people get a hold of you if they'd like to talk with you and learn more about you or adopt you as a doctor in their lives?
I put a tremendous amount of content on social media. So the biggest one today, without a doubt, is Facebook. So just go to Gabe Roberts, G-A-B-E Roberts on Facebook. Dr. Gabe Roberts, I do have a professional page on there. And I put a lot of educational content there for people to kind of read and understand some of the things we talked about today. As well as an email to get to contact me directly would be info@elevateyourfield.com. So it's elevateyourfield.com.
info@elevateyourfield.com.
Yes, sir.
Well, Gabe, thank you very much. You've been wonderful. I've learned a lot today, and definitely look forward to continuing this discussion and doing it again.
Excellent, Michael. Thank you very much. I look forward to it as well.
So there we have another Unstoppable Mindset podcast, and it is as unexpected as it gets, and we got to talk about lots of different things. I hope that you will all give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to learn more and to subscribe directly, feel free to visit me at www.michaelhingson.com, michaelhingson.com/podcast. Thank you again for listening. Join us again for more episodes of Unstoppable Mindset.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled AccessiBE. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.